Chapter 26. Things Fall Apart. A more fiscally restrained person would perhaps have organized a different CONCACAF Congress than the one put on at the Atlantis Paradise Island Resort in the Bahamas on April 16, 2015. It might not have been strictly necessary to put up dozens of staffers in luxury rooms, to arrive on a private jet, to host multiple late-night parties with open bars, or to rent out multiple suites for oneself, one's friends, and one's family, also flown in on the Confederation's dime. The event, which cost CONCACAF roughly $3 million, could, quite possibly, have been carried off with a slightly more modest touch, but that wouldn't have been Jeffrey Webb's style. The Confederation president had been traveling nonstop, as was his habit, and bringing a growing retinue of friends and advisors along with him. He'd swept into the Bahamas, in fact, right after returning from a trip to Cairo, where he had attended the Congress of the Confederation of African Football, along with Enrique Sanz and both of their wives. That event had been nice, but CONCACAF's was going to be a blowout. It was a chance to show the world, and particularly Sepp Blatter, who would be in attendance, how far the Confederation had progressed in the 3 years since Webb had replaced Jack Warner. The Atlantis, a well-appointed yet thoroughly glitzy establishment, was overrun by uniformed Confederation staffers, and a huge video screen looping highlights of Webb's accomplishments loomed over the event. Blatter arrived at the Atlantis on the 15th, stepping out of a chauffeured Mercedes sedan in a light sport coat and white shirt, looking a bit tired. The 79-year-old was in full campaign mode, and had dropped in on nearly every FIFA event on the schedule over the previous few months. But the Caribbean was special. The region had been his political base since Jack Warner supported his first presidential campaign in 1998. And in Webb, Blatter had found a loyal successor. In fact, the two men had been scratching each other's backs for more than a dozen years. In 2002, when he was just 37, and all but unknown in soccer circles, Webb had risen to defend Blatter, then facing corruption accusations from his own general secretary and multiple members of the FIFA executive committee. At the FIFA Congress in the Grand Hilton Seoul, Blatter had denied requests from 15 different member associations to speak, among them Somalia, the Netherlands, and England. But Webb was given the floor, and he responded by suggesting, as a banker, that the soccer body's finances were just fine, and that he didn't know what all the fuss was about. "FIFA is family," Webb had said, "and family must stay together." He was rewarded with his first FIFA appointment, as deputy director of the Internal Audit Committee, and 2 years after that, FIFA pledged $2.2 million toward building a center of excellence in the Cayman Islands. In 2009, Blatter, flanked by Warner, visited Webb at home to celebrate the inauguration of a small office built with some of the funds, the majority of which were sent to the local soccer association and never fully accounted for. Webb, calling Blatter the father of our football family, hosted a black tie gala in his honor. In 2013, Blatter named Webb chairman of a new task force against racism and discrimination, and that October proclaimed that FIFA could have a new president in the near future, and that person could be Jeffrey Webb, a coy prediction that vastly elevated the Confederation president's status. Now in the Bahamas, it was once again Webb's turn to be helpful. He complied by barring what he termed political speeches at the Congress, thus preventing Blatter's rivals for the presidency, Prince Ali bin al-Hussein of Jordan, Michael van Praag of Holland, and former star midfielder Luis Figo of Portugal, all of whom were in attendance, from even addressing the Congress. It was the same trick Warner had pulled all the way back in 2002. "Webb," Blatter told the delegates, "is my colleague, my friend, my brother," and once again suggested that he saw in the Caymanian a likely heir to his throne. "He is a winner," Blatter said, "so let's see where he's going." As far as Webb was concerned, however, the day's main event came when he was elected by the Confederation's membership associations to serve a second term as its president. It was a formality, as Webb again ran unopposed, but he nonetheless treated the vote as if it were a glorious victory. CONCACAF, Webb said in a statement, is more than ever united by one vision. That vision, of course, was his. Indeed, the entire Congress seemed carefully planned to impart to Webb a still greater air of importance. Attendees, including a large press contingent, were barraged with a series of cheerful reports about the Confederation's activities, its successful reforms, and its ambitious plans for the future. Enrique Sanz, looking drawn and pale, his once thick locks reduced to a thin buzz cut after all the cancer treatments, announced that the Confederation would report a $1.1 million budget surplus for the fiscal year, to the nodding approval of the audience. But that figure, like so much of what was really happening in the Confederation, was a lie. When CONCACAF's finance department crunched the numbers a few weeks earlier, they projected a $6.5 million loss for the year, due in large part to ballooning marketing and travel expenses. Yet Webb had rejected that data in favor of rosier numbers. After publicly refusing compensation following his initial election, Webb had begun quietly taking a $2 million salary and dropped as much as $100,000 apiece on international junkets, trotting around the world with his friends aboard private jets, chartered by a travel agency that had offered him kickbacks in exchange for the Confederation's book of business. The Congress itself had originally been planned for the Cayman Islands, but had been relocated to the Bahamas, at significant cost and with little explanation. The unmentioned reason was that Webb had not set foot in his native land since Canover Watson's arrest the previous August, and had no intention of going back. Watson had been formally charged in November 2014 with corruption, money laundering, and fraud, and was awaiting trial. At one point, Webb had sent his wife to Georgetown to take care of a few affairs, but the local police had picked her up for questioning. Since then, Webb had lived in constant terror that the investigation of Watson, his best friend, would catch up with him. He'd warned Costas Takis, his bagman, to avoid Cayman as well. Everywhere Webb went at the Bahamas Congress, he was surrounded by three enormous and intimidating bodyguards who prevented anyone from approaching him. Normally eager for press, he denied interview requests and avoided journalists. Isolated and paranoid, Webb gamely presented an optimistic face, projecting himself as a future president of FIFA. But it was increasingly a shell game. He'd worked out under-the-table deals with more than a dozen vendors that benefited him at the Confederation's expense, and as a result, the Confederation's cash reserves were dwindling. The Copa America Centenario represented a huge influx, to be sure, but it was a one-time event that would have been worth at least $5 million more if not for Webb's greed. Bean counters in the finance office had bleakly started to warn that the Confederation would soon be insolvent. Yet none of that prevented Webb from throwing one more party in his own honor. After the Congress at the Atlantis concluded, revelers stayed up all night, a DJ played, and alcohol flowed. The party alone, Confederation employees whispered to one another, cost $70,000. Among the hundreds of soccer officials, sports marketing executives, staffers, caterers, vendors, athletes, wives, girlfriends, and other soccer creatures who had convened at the Atlantis Resort, one attendee in particular stood out. FBI agent Jared Randall. The CONCACAF Congress was the last chance to make clandestine recordings of large numbers of soccer officials before the takedown in Zurich, which was now a little more than a month away. Once the whole world knew what the feds had been up to, it was going to be far tougher to get people to chat openly about corrupt acts. With that in mind, Randall had pulled together an operation in the Bahamas. Unlike previous undertakings, such as the 2012 visit to London, the schedule was less scripted and more open to improvisation this time. Also, unlike prior trips, Randall went alone. Once he checked into the Atlantis, he'd meet with Enrique Sanz, wire him up, and put the cooperator to work. The young general secretary was so well placed within CONCACAF, and such a rising star in the soccer world, that he could doubtless get in a room with anybody, even perhaps Sepp Blatter himself. despite his serious health problems. Sands had proven a very enterprising and discreet cooperator. With any luck, they'd develop some damning new evidence. And in any case, it was a great opportunity for Randall to personally take in the kind of lavish FIFA-related event he'd been hearing about for nearly 5 years. That was the plan. Get in, watch some soccer officials, and go home. But Randall didn't figure that people would be watching him, too. In addition to the beefy security guards, Jeffrey Webb had brought a small detail of private detectives from Miami to the Bahamas. Paranoid about the criminal case in the Cayman Islands, and petrified there might be leaks, the CONCACAF president had become convinced that there was a mole inside the Confederation and could think of little else. One of those private eyes made Randall within hours of his arrival, sitting in shorts on a sofa in a public area, playing with his cell phone and carrying a backpack. Something about him just didn't look right. He wasn't talking to anyone. He wasn't taking part in any of the CONCACAF events. And oddly, he kept lugging the backpack everywhere he went. On a hunch, the investigator followed him as Randall walked through the sprawling hotel and then stepped outside through a glass door for what turned out to be a face-to-face meeting with Enrique Sands. He snapped a photo of the encounter on his cell phone and forwarded it to his boss. Why the hell was the General Secretary of CONCACAF secretly meeting with this outsider? The uneasy feeling grew even stronger that evening, when Randall was spotted lurking outside a barbecue for CONCACAF's guests, still in shorts when everyone else was dressed up for the evening, and still with the backpack. After conferring, the private eyes decided to take action. They confronted Randall, asking him who he was and what he was doing there. The FBI agent was suddenly put in an impossible position. If he told the truth, it risked the whole investigation. Word of an American soccer corruption probe would spread through the hotel like a virus, and the Zurich takedown could be completely blown up. But if he were caught in a lie, on the other hand, things could get very sour for Randall in a hurry. When he didn't respond, the private eyes said they were going to call the police. All color drained from his face, the agent returned to his room, packed his bags, headed straight to the airport, and flew home. Randall's operation was over. One morning early in May, Roberta Sands returned home from dropping her son at school to find her husband, Enrique, collapsed and unresponsive on the floor. Their house in Coral Gables happened to be directly across the street from Mercy Miami Hospital, and Sands was rushed to the emergency room. He was unresponsive, as if in a coma, and nobody knew for sure what had happened to him. It was critical, the doctor said, to find out. Since being diagnosed with a particularly nasty form of leukemia, the CONCACAF General Secretary had spent considerable time in therapy battling the disease. He had officially returned to work on January 1st, but relapses were common with his condition, and he had expressed increasing exasperation at the treatment options. Stem cell transplants, his best hope, often had even worse side effects than chemo. Sands, frustrated and tired, had been trying alternative therapies, including blue scorpion venom, an allegedly miraculous cancer cure that originated in Cuba and had never been approved by the FDA. Could Sands have taken too much and poisoned himself, or had some sort of allergic reaction? Desperate, Roberta Sands took her husband's cell phone from his hospital room. Maybe it contained some hint at what he'd been doing that could help the doctors caring for him. The phone had been issued by CONCACAF, and figuring someone at the Confederation could unlock it, she made sure it got to Webb, who had been deeply shaken by news of Sands's collapse. He, in turn, handed it to Eladio Paez, a private investigator he had hired to watch his back. Paez, a former Miami police detective, had been working for Webb for more than 2 years. In that time, he had performed countless odd jobs, researching the backgrounds of Central American soccer officials, for example, or organizing a security detail for a trip to El Salvador. Bald and stocky, with glasses and a salt-and-pepper beard, Baez had struck a close relationship with Webb, who spent more and more time brooding over the ongoing criminal investigation of Canover Watson. In February, Watson's personal assistant had been charged in the probe. In early April, prosecutors in Cayman said they had located new evidence, including emails, suggesting that more people could be implicated in the case, and that an unnamed third party was helping fund Watson's defense. Pies had warned Webb repeatedly that there could be additional criminal investigations in other jurisdictions, including and especially the United States. He pointed to the reports of Chuck Blazer wearing a wire, and of Darion Warner cooperating as well. But Webb brushed off those matters as legacies of the past administration, and of no concern to him. The private eye unlocked the phone and copied its contents. He then began methodically reviewing its files. Among the first things he checked were the device's messages, which is where he discovered text after text from FBI agent Jared Randall, who was labeled J-Rod in the phone's address book. The messages, dating back months, mentioned prosecutors, an investigation, and secret recordings. They left Pies little doubt about what had been going on. Webb had been right. There was a mole in CONCACAF. Over the previous few years, Jeffrey Webb had amassed an impressive array of luxury goods, including 5 Rolexes and more than a half dozen other high-end watches, as well as a jewelry case overflowing with diamonds and pearls that he'd given to his second wife. He owned 5 houses in the U.S., including the remodeled 3-story mansion outside Atlanta where he lived, and the couple owned a Mercedes-Benz and a Range Rover. And then Webb bought himself a $263,553 Ferrari 458 Spider. The Ferrari convertible was a growling modern chariot, proclaiming that a man had unquestionably made it, and wasn't afraid, indeed very much wanted, to be caught in the act of being important. Webb hadn't grown up wealthy. His father was an immigrant from Jamaica, and the family had struggled at times when he was young. He'd gotten involved in soccer when he was young, and though the Cayman Islands Football Association had never fielded anything close to a respectable national team, he'd managed to bring it some repute and considerably more cash over the years. The way Webb saw it, CONCACAF was just a stepping stone. He was being groomed for greatness. Someday, maybe in just 4 scant years, he would be sitting atop the soccer world, the first black man to lead the most powerful sporting organization in the world. The Italian supercar, in a very noticeable way, spoke to that ambition. On May 1st, 2015, Webb registered his brand new fire engine red Ferrari with the Georgia Department of Revenue. The soccer official put the title in his wife's name, but there was no question about who the vehicle was for. He paid extra for vanity plates bearing his initials, J.W. 3 weeks later, Webb boarded a flight bound for Zurich to attend FIFA's annual Congress. He would never drive his new car again. Chapter 27. Takedown. Steve Berryman ate a light dinner at a downtown Manhattan restaurant on the evening of Tuesday, May 26th, 2015, then went back to his hotel to take a nap. It was hard to slow his rapidly spinning thoughts enough to fall asleep, but somehow the IRS agent managed to squeeze an hour and a half in before he rose, got dressed, and headed out into the cool spring night. He arrived at the entrance of 26 Federal Plaza shortly after 11 that night, where he met Richard Weber, the chief of the IRS Criminal Investigation Division, along with his small retinue of advisors and a public information officer. They rode up the elevator to the FBI field office, nervously chattering, and went into a long, wide chamber that everyone referred to as the War Room. Inside were rows of tables, whiteboards, and toward the back of the room several televisions turned to cable news stations with the volume muted. Evan Norris and the 4 other assistant United States attorneys on the case were already there, as was John Penza, the head of the FBI's Eurasian Organized Crime Squad, and several other FBI agents who had helped out. Someone had brought a box of donuts. Most big field offices have a war room, staffed around the clock by agents monitoring different activities of the Bureau. They are also frequently used for important operations. What was coming in about 45 minutes certainly qualified. There was an almost giddy anticipation in the room as everyone greeted one another, shaking hands and trading smiles. An enormous amount of work had led up to this moment, and it was finally showtime. Norris had begun writing the indictment around the beginning of the year, but in reality he'd been carefully crafting and refining it for far longer, ever since Chuck Blazer pleaded guilty. He'd been making frequent trips to Washington to consult with attorneys in the Justice Department's organized crime and gang section, fine-tuning his drafts to make sure that his central argument, that RICO applied because soccer itself had become a corrupt criminal enterprise, would stick. After many late nights and working weekends, Norris had finished a draft of the indictment in early March, in anticipation of the quarterly FIFA Exco meetings that were scheduled for later that month. The Swiss, after multiple visits from Norris and other American officials, had agreed to assist with the case, but at the last minute put off the March takedown, saying there wasn't enough time to arrange everything. By then, however, the prosecutors had already submitted their first Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, MLAT, request to Switzerland. An MLAT was the equivalent of an international subpoena, explaining the nature of the investigation and identifying nearly two dozen possible targets. It formally requested information on 55 different bank accounts, a copy of the Garcia report filed to FIFA the previous autumn, and files from the long-concluded ISL investigation. The nearly 60-page MLAT, which was translated into German, was filed on March 17th, and a second one, requesting information on additional bank accounts, was filed with Switzerland's Federal Office of Justice on April 21st. Berryman had arrived in New York in early May, working around the clock with a young prosecutor named Keith Edelman, who had been added to the case to help bring it home. The two meticulously prepared additional MLATs they would be sending out to other countries once the indictment was public. When the MLATs were completed, they had to draft scores of seizure warrants. Berryman had a list of all the bank accounts spread all over the world that he'd identified as belonging to each defendant. A key part of the strategy was to squeeze the defendants financially. Even as the Swiss police were dragging people off to jail, their accounts would be frozen, making them more vulnerable and, it was hoped, favorably inclined to cut a deal with the prosecutors. Finally, there was grand jury preparation. Berryman and Randall had spent hours with the prosecutors going over the testimony they'd be giving, carefully rehearsing exactly what they'd say in order to help convince at least 12 citizens that they should return the indictment as a true bill, giving the investigators the green light. The key was Norris's finished indictment. Nobody on the case had ever seen anything like it. It was what is known as a speaking indictment, which meant that rather than just reciting the 47 different crimes it charged, the document recounted in detail the narrative behind the allegations. At 161 pages, it read like a carefully researched work of nonfiction, telling the complicated tale of several generations of soccer officials and sports marketing executives who took and received bribes to further their corrupt ends. The argument could have been ripped nearly verbatim from one of Norris's mafia cases. FIFA and its myriad regional confederations and national associations, he wrote, were in fact part of a single enterprise that over the past 25 years had been corrupted by its own officials, engaging in various criminal activities, including fraud, bribery, and money laundering, in pursuit of personal and commercial gain. A critical lever in the case was the concept of honest services fraud, which is most often used against crooked public officials. Under the Code of Ethics of FIFA and of the regional confederations, soccer officials were bound not to take bribes and kickbacks. By taking bribes and kickbacks, therefore, these officials had deprived the soccer organizations they worked for of their rights to their honest and faithful services. Because the officials used email, telephones, text messages, and bank transfers to negotiate and accept the bribes. They were being charged with wire fraud and wire fraud conspiracy. Since the officials also attempted to conceal the location and ownership of proceeds of these activities through elaborate layers of shell companies, overseas bank accounts, and phony contracts, they were being charged with money laundering and money laundering conspiracy. And finally, because the officials secretly plotted with one another to corrupt and twist the soccer bodies for their own personal gain and had defrauded the organizations they were chosen to serve, they were being charged with RICO conspiracy. To counter potential criticisms that the case involved judicial overreach and was an example of America applying its laws on other countries, the indictment was carefully crafted to charge crimes that, at some point, took place on U.S. soil. Money passing through domestic correspondent banks, for example, or bribery schemes hatched on phone calls made to Florida. The indictment also sidestepped another possible broadside, that commercial bribery wasn't even illegal in some of the defendants' countries. That was irrelevant. The officials were being charged with using American wires to defraud their soccer organizations of their honest services, not of breaking bribery laws. It was immensely complicated, but in essence, Norris's theory boiled down to this. If Traffic paid Jeffrey Webb $1 million under the table to sign a Gold Cup rights contract, CONCACAF had not only been cheated out of the value of the bribe, which was money that could have been paid directly to the Confederation, but also whatever higher price it would have received for the rights had a fair and competitive bidding process been allowed to take place. And because all these soccer organizations were created to develop and promote the game of soccer globally, Norris wrote, the ultimate victims of the rampant corruption were all of the sport's hundreds of millions of stakeholders. Picture, in other words, the impoverished, soccer-loving child of the developing world, with no pitch to play on, no cleats to wear, and no ball to kick. That hypothetical child, tears streaming down his grimy little face, was the one who ultimately suffered from the towering greed of Chuck Blazer, Jose Avila, Jeffrey Webb, and all the other rotten soccer officials around the world. On Wednesday, May 20th, the prosecutors, as well as Berryman and Jared Randall, went into the grand jury room in the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse and asked for permission to indict Jeffrey Webb, Jack Warner, Nicolas Leos, Aaron Davidson, Alejandro Burzaco, Hugo and Mariano Hincas, Kostas Takis, and six other soccer officials. The grand jury returned the indictment, and it was placed under seal. The following day, May 21st, formal arrest requests were transmitted to the Swiss authorities, along with a third MLAT requesting yet more bank records. Everything was ready. Since the regional soccer confederations were holding their meetings in Zurich on the 26th, and FIFA's Congress began on the 28th, the plan was to strike on May 27th. To avoid attention, the Swiss had asked that no American law enforcement be on hand. Plainclothes Swiss police would start at the Bauer au Lac Hotel, where the EXCO members were staying. There would be no guns, no dark blue windbreakers, no bulletproof vests, and no handcuffs. The police would be gone before anyone else in the hotel had even gotten out of bed. If everything went according to plan, nobody would even know what happened until the indictment was unsealed at a press conference in Brooklyn hours later. At 10 minutes before midnight, the team in the New York field office raised an FBI agent posted in Switzerland on an international line. He was waiting near the Bauer au Lac and would pass along information as it came in. Things got very quiet in the war room. It was time. At precisely 6 in the morning on May 27th, 2015, a beautiful, cloudless spring day in Zurich, roughly a half dozen policemen, dressed in jeans, tennis shoes, and light jackets, walked through the revolving doors of the Bauer au Lac and approached the front desk. The small lobby, surprisingly austere for a hotel that charged more than $600 a night for its cheapest room, was nearly vacant. The police quietly explained why they were there, asking for room numbers and keys, which the clerk gave them before calling the rooms to alert the guests to what was coming. Then, just a few minutes later, something unexpected happened. The scroll across the bottom of the CNN feed on one of the televisions in the FBI war room, which had been carrying reports of the National Basketball Association finals and a heat wave in India, suddenly displayed a new message. U.S. to announce corruption charges against senior officials at FIFA, World Soccer's governing body, officials say. The takedown had been treated with the utmost secrecy. Some people on the team hadn't even told their spouses. Paranoia ran so high that the IRS commissioner, John Koskinen, had been informed of the investigation only that very day because he had once been president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, and there were concerns he might inadvertently let slip about the case to a friend involved in the sport. Yet somehow, despite the best efforts of the prosecutors, someone had leaked. More than an hour before the Swiss police arrived at the Bar au Lac, two New York Times reporters and a photographer had arrived at the hotel. At 5:52 a.m. Zurich time, the newspaper posted a carefully edited story on its website under the headline, FIFA Officials Face Corruption Charges in U.S. The story quoted an anonymous law enforcement official. "We're struck by just how long this went on for and how it touched nearly every part of what FIFA did." The journalists, a criminal justice reporter who had flown in from the U.S. and a European sports correspondent, sat quietly in the lobby, discreetly snapping pictures with their mobile phones as the police arrived. 26 minutes after posting the first story, the newspaper updated it to confirm that arrests were taking place in Zurich. Swiss authorities began an extraordinary early morning operation here Wednesday to arrest several top soccer officials and extradite them to the United States on federal corruption charges, the article said, noting that the case was out of the Eastern District of New York and that the still-sealed indictment alleged wire fraud, money laundering, and racketeering. This time, the quote from the unnamed law enforcement official, who clearly knew the case well, had been removed. The New York Times reporters had begun tweeting out photos of the raid, almost in real time, and their story was quickly picked up by other outlets, including CNN, rocketing around the world, far too fast to keep up with. Norris turned to Berryman, who was standing next to him in the big room. He leaned close so they couldn't be overheard. The normally controlled prosecutor was apoplectic, as angry as he had ever been. "Those motherfuckers," he said. "Those motherfuckers." Jeffrey Webb had arrived in Zurich in time to attend FIFA's ExCo meeting, which was scheduled for Monday afternoon and Tuesday morning. It would be a relatively long stay, as a second extraordinary meeting of the ExCo was scheduled for Saturday, the day after the presidential election. From there, he'd fly directly to New Zealand for the Under-20 World Cup. Tuesday, May 26th, had been busy. Webb and his wife were staying at the Bor Olak, but most of CONCACAF's delegates, as well as those from CONMEBOL, were staying at the Renaissance Zurich Tower, a slightly less luxurious, business-oriented hotel 15 minutes away. Webb's schedule on what had been a gray overcast Tuesday included a ceremony with Juan Ángel Naput, the latest president of CONMEBOL, to announce the signing of a strategic alliance between the two confederations. After that, CONCACAF's delegates gathered to hear final campaign appeals from Sepp Blatter and Jordan's Prince Ali, the only rival candidate still in contention for the FIFA presidency. All the others had dropped out. That evening, Webb hosted a cocktail party for his confederation's delegates at the Sheraton. It was late when Webb finally walked through the Bor au Lac's revolving doors, arm draped around his wife's shoulder. They went upstairs to bed, and were still sound asleep when the Swiss police knocked, politely told Webb to get dressed and pack a bag, then escorted him outside to an unmarked car. By the time the officers had escorted his colleague, Eduardo Lee, a Costa Rican member of the ExCo, downstairs, droves of reporters were descending on the Bor au Lac. Panicked hotel employees, desperate to protect guests' privacy, scurried ahead, ushering Lee out a side entrance. One particularly diligent staffer draped a bedsheet between the hotel door and the unmarked opal hatchback waiting for Lee by the curb, preventing a photographer from taking his picture. Within minutes, that iconic image of freshly laundered linen hiding the identity of a soccer official arrested for being dirty would spread around the world. Upstairs in one of the hotel's suites, Neusa Marin, the wife of former Brazilian Soccer Confederation president Josi Maria Marin, desperately dialed the room of Marco Polo Del Nero, who had succeeded her husband atop the CBF in March. The police had come knocking a few minutes earlier, and while her husband packed a bag of clothes to take to jail, she begged Del Nero to help. He told her to remain calm and said he'd be there shortly. "He's coming," Neuza assured her 83-year-old husband. But Del Nero didn't come. Instead, he went downstairs, had breakfast, attended an emergency meeting for Brazilian soccer officials in another hotel, then went to the Zurich airport and flew back to Brazil. Among those also breakfasting in the hotel's restaurant that morning was Alejandro Borsacco. He had arrived in Zurich the day before, but was staying a few blocks away at the Park Hyatt. The head of Torneios y Competencias had previously made plans to meet the new president of CONMEBOL at the Boer Olak at 9 to discuss bribe payments for the Copa Libertadores, and had left his hotel half an hour early. On his walk over, Borsacco received two text messages telling him to look at the New York Times. There was an American criminal investigation into soccer corruption, there were arrests, and he was somehow mixed up in it. Alarmed, but also curious, he continued to the hotel to see what it was all about. When he arrived, the Boer Olak was ringed by throngs of reporters, and security guards had closed the main entrance, but Borsacco was allowed into the restaurant through a side door. Inside the breakfast room, he found a chaotic scene. Crying wives whose husbands had been dragged away. Frantic soccer officials trying to hire criminal lawyers for their arrested colleagues. The raid had happened hours earlier. The police were no longer around, and nobody knew exactly what was going on. Borsacco ordered food, staying for nearly an hour and a half, as he gravely discussed the situation with friends and colleagues. People wondered who had been arrested, and whether the investigation would affect FIFA's presidential election on Friday. After breakfast, the Argentine went upstairs to visit another soccer official in his room, then left the hotel and walked to a nearby cafe where he met a lawyer to discuss his situation. In the cafe, he called the son-in-law of his deceased friend, Julio Grondona, who was also in Zurich, and asked if he could drive him to Italy right away. Within hours, Borsacco was in Milan, far from the Swiss police. The authorities did manage to track down Rafael Esquivel, who had been president of Venezuela's soccer federation for 28 years, and stood accused of taking bribes from Avila, Borsacco, and the Hinkeses for both the Copa America and the Copa Libertadores. He was staying at the Renaissance and breakfasting with Luis Segura, who had taken over Argentina's soccer association after Grondona had died. As they ate, the two men excitedly discussed the arrests, wondering whether they might somehow be implicated. "Hey, look," Segura suddenly blurted out as he scrolled through his phone. "Your name is on the list." Esquivel was escorted out of the hotel by Swiss police a few minutes later, dragging a wheeled suitcase behind him. Barraged by calls from reporters, the Swiss authorities soon acknowledged the arrests, breaking with the day's carefully scripted plan. Swiss privacy laws prohibit the publication of a defendant's name or image until the person is convicted. But May 27th had quickly turned into an anarchic free-for-all. "We were under orders to conduct the arrests in secret, avoiding photographs." One of the officers arresting Esquivel confessed to a reporter who witnessed the scene firsthand. The FBI agent in Zurich, in constant contact with Swiss authorities, relayed news of each successive arrest to his colleagues in New York. The defendants' names had been written on a whiteboard, and agents crossed them off one by one as arrests were confirmed for Webb, Lee, Julio Rocha, Costas Takis, Eugenio Figueiredo, Marin, and finally, Esquivel. and that was it. The raid, he said, was finished. It was only half their list. The prosecutors knew that Warner was in Trinidad, and a provisional arrest request was already on its way to Port of Spain, with another one heading to Paraguay for Nicolás Leos. But they had hoped to sweep up Borzaco as well as Hugo and Mariana Hinkes in the Zurich raids. Was it possible they had been alerted by the press and escaped? Berryman finally left the New York field office around 2:30 in the morning. He still had a long day ahead, but for the moment, there wasn't much to do except try to get a few hours' sleep. As he walked, Berryman noticed how empty the streets of Manhattan were at that hour. He had just taken part in the biggest, most difficult, and exciting piece of law enforcement work of his entire life. News of the raids would throw Europe into chaotic turmoil, shutting out everything else. Yet here in the financial capital of the world, where so much of the bribe money had flowed through over the years, and where the criminal case had been made, it seemed as if nothing had happened at all. Holy shit, Berryman thought to himself as he walked. Holy shit. The knock on Aaron Davidson's door came well before sunrise. He'd bought the three-bedroom condo on the 12th floor of a tower on Brickell Key in late 2012, right around the time Sands had bought his house in Coconut Grove. Traffic's office was just a short stroll across the island, and Davidson's unit, which had cost $1.2 million, had a spacious balcony overlooking Biscayne Bay and a nice gym. He had gone to bed Tuesday night before the news broke and was oblivious to the tumult sweeping the soccer world when Jared Randall and several other federal agents arrived bearing an arrest warrant. Davidson was surprised, but he could feel a light coming on in his head. So many of the strange things that had happened over the past few years suddenly began to make sense now, and he felt a slow swelling of hurt and anger at Avila welling up. It was Avila, he now realized, who had betrayed him, urging him to take that sudden and peculiar trip to the hotel bar near LaGuardia the previous year. It was Avila who had assured him endlessly that the investigation had nothing to do with him, that he was safe, that he wasn't being investigated. It had all been a lie. How could he have been so stupid? Davidson was struck by how friendly Randall was, and didn't resist. As had Avila, Darion, and Daryl Warner, he went along with the agents to the FBI field office, hired a lawyer, waived his right to a first appearance in Miami, and flew to New York in custody. He was the eighth person arrested that day. Randall had flown to Miami the previous day, insisting on being there rather than in the war room with the other core members of the team. After arresting Davidson, Randall rushed to South Beach to join a group of FBI and IRS agents serving a search warrant on CONCACAF's headquarters. Those agents had arrived before 6 a.m. in an unmarked minivan with dozens of cardboard boxes and showed the warrant to the building's security. Like everything else in the carefully orchestrated takedown, the raid was supposed to be conducted in secret so that it could be announced when the indictment was unsealed later that day. But somehow, a television camera crew was already waiting for them when they arrived, and filmed the whole operation. At 10:30 a.m., Norris, in a conservative gray suit, white shirt, and blue tie, stood attentively with his hands clasped before a packed room of reporters and cameramen in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, listening to other people describe his case to the world. The big guns were all there. Loretta Lynch, who had begun serving as Attorney General only a month before, after one of the most drawn-out confirmation fights in history, spoke first. Then it was her replacement in Brooklyn, Acting U.S. Attorney Kelly Curry, followed by FBI Director James Comey, who at 6'8", towered over the diminutive new Attorney General. Richard Weber, the shiny-headed IRS Criminal Investigation Chief, came next, proudly delivering a showstopper he had rehearsed leading up to the press conference. "This really is the World Cup of fraud," he said. "And today we are issuing FIFA a red card." Norris had helped draft all the talking points, prepared charts explaining how the bribery schemes worked, and put together the press release and information packet handed out to reporters. He'd won admiration from his peers in the Justice Department at how long he'd kept things quiet. And even other prosecutors in Brooklyn marveled at how tight-lipped he'd been about the case that had dominated his life for nearly 5 years. After nearly 40 minutes, a reporter asked a detailed question about the Copa America, and Curry, who had zero involvement with the case until he joined the Eastern District of New York late the previous year, beckoned Norris to the microphone. Finally, Norris had a chance to claim credit for all his hard work. His moment in the spotlight, however, lasted no more than 30 seconds. "The indictment is very detailed, and there's a table of contents on the second page," he said, looking even more serious than usual. "I'd just refer you to the Copa America scheme." That was all Norris said. The press conference was supposed to have been the first time the world heard about the takedown, about the indictment, and about the guilty pleas from Blazer, Avila, and the Warner Brothers, all of which were being unsealed at the same time. That was the plan. Soon thereafter, the Swiss Attorney General would announce its own criminal investigation, focused on the bidding for the 2018 and 2022 World Cups, and inform the public that, in addition to the arrests, it had raided FIFA headquarters that morning. But it hadn't worked out that way. The Swiss authorities were furious because the leak had compromised the privacy of the defendants and drawn journalists to FIFA's headquarters to witness what was supposed to be a clandestine raid by the police. Even more embarrassing, the presence of New York Times reporters in the hotel had given the public the impression that Switzerland's police force acted at the beck and call of American law enforcement. It was, to put it mildly, an awkward situation. Still, if the goal was to attract publicity, it worked. The news was big in the U.S., but elsewhere it was as if a nuclear bomb had been detonated. There was no other topic of discussion. America had taken on soccer corruption, something nobody thought would ever happen anywhere, and Loretta Lynch had crowned herself with glory on her first major case as Attorney General. Amid the frenzy, FIFA had already held its own impromptu press conference. A spokesman, Walter De Gregorio, bizarrely claimed credit for the investigation and assured the press multiple times that the presidential elections would still take place 2 days hence. Sepp Blatter, a testy De Gregorio said, is quite relaxed because he knows and he knew it before, and he has confirmed once again today that he is not involved. Mohammed bin Hammam and Vitaly Mutko, Russia's sports minister, both weighed in on the news hours before the indictment was unsealed. Even Jack Warner, ensconced in Trinidad, managed to get a word in before the people who actually put together the most important criminal case in the history of soccer had a chance to speak. "If U.S. Justice Department wants me, they know where to find me," Warner told a reporter. "I sleep very soundly in the night." Less than 3 hours later, Warner surrendered to police in Port of Spain. Although a magistrate agreed to bail of 2.5 million Trinidad dollars, or roughly $400,000, Warner wasn't able to present the proper paperwork in time, and he was forced to spend the night in jail. A provisional arrest warrant was sent to Paraguay as well. But before it could be served, Nicolas Leoz checked himself into a hospital, claiming he'd suffered a coronary crisis. Sources close to his lawyers coyly noted that Paraguay's criminal code prohibits imprisonment of anyone suffering from a serious illness. Argentina, too, had received provisional warrants. But so far, nobody had been arrested, meaning there were at least three defendants unaccounted for, Burzaco and the two Hincases. Randall finished serving the warrant in Miami, flew back to New York, and began preparing so-called red notices to submit to Interpol, which would alert every country in the world to detain the remaining defendants if they attempted to cross their borders. Next came the extradition requests. There were seven men sitting in jail in Zurich, plus Warner in Trinidad and Leoz in Paraguay, and the United States had to formally request extradition for each. There was, in other words, a tremendous amount of work still to be done. As night approached, people on the case began trickling out of the U.S. Attorney's office in Brooklyn and heading home. A few had managed to catch some sleep in the hours between the midnight takedown and the press conference, but everyone was exhausted. Norris, still fuming about the leak, eventually left as well. He didn't say a word about Peter Luger, the steakhouse where he'd been planning to take Randall and Berryman to celebrate. Chapter 28. A Great Day for Football. 13 hours before the takedown, Zorana Danis walked into a federal courtroom in Brooklyn, flanked by her lawyers. With so much happening that day,
the prosecution could spare just a single assistant U.S. attorney, Sam Nitze,
who had joined the case about a year earlier to witness Danis's moment of truth. Charming and personable, the owner of International Soccer Marketing had grown popular with the investigators since she flipped in late 2013. She had helped them understand some of the complexities of South American soccer and had been instrumental in building the case against Nicolas Leos. Danis was being allowed to plead to just 2 counts, neither of them involving racketeering. One was wire fraud conspiracy for some of the bribes she paid in exchange for Copa Libertadores sponsorship rights, and the other was for making a false statement on her tax returns, because she had tried to write off a $1.25 million bribe as a deductible expense. "I knew that my conduct in paying these bribes and kickbacks was wrong," Danis, who also agreed to forfeit $2 million, told the judge. "It shouldn't have happened." The following morning, when the big indictment was unsealed in Brooklyn, so too were the charging documents against Blazer, Avila, and the two Warner brothers. But Danis's was not. In fact, the prosecutors had made absolutely sure that not a single word about her was uttered to anyone at all. In RICO cases, prosecutors rarely consider the investigation to be finished when the indictment is handed down. In fact, that's often just the beginning. Long before they ever face the grand jury, prosecutors are planning a second charging document, called a superseding indictment, that expands the number of defendants. The first indictment itself can be a critical tool in getting there. In writing that document, Norris made sure to describe each criminal conspiracy in detail, identifying the role played by every defendant, while liberally salting in clues about bank accounts, shell companies, and other potential evidence. He also filled the indictment with mentions of unnamed co-conspirators, 25 in all, leaving strong hints about who each was. Co-conspirator number 10, for example, was described as a high-ranking official of FIFA, CONMEBOL, and the Asociación del Fútbol Argentino, which identified him as Julio Grondona. Co-conspirator number 7 was clearly Mohammed bin Hammam, mentioned as a high-ranking official at FIFA and AFC, the regional confederation representing much of Asia, who ran for the FIFA presidency in 2011. Co-conspirator number 5 was the controlling principal of a Jersey City company that controlled sponsorship and title sponsorship rights associated with the Copa Libertadores, and who paid bribes and kickbacks to the defendant Nicolas Leos, and others to keep those rights. The only person who could possibly fit that description was Zorana Danis. When the indictment was unsealed, Norris knew that it would spread like wildfire among crooked soccer officials the world over. They would scrutinize every line, trying to decipher how the case developed, where it was going, and whether they might also be under investigation. The description of co-conspirator number 5 would identify Zorana Danis to those who knew her. Norris had done that quite deliberately. And by keeping her guilty plea a secret, the prosecution was signaling that she must be a target as well. Someone would almost certainly call Danis to discuss bribes, to ask her what she knew, or to tell her to keep her mouth shut, never suspecting that she was cooperating with the feds and would be recording all her calls. That was the beauty of a richly detailed speaking indictment. As soon as it drops, phones start ringing off the hook. The morning after the arrests, CONCACAF convened an emergency meeting in Zurich to install a new president. Alfredo Howard of Honduras was the Confederation's most senior vice president, and thus by statute automatically assumed the post. Just as, ironically, Lyle Austin had unsuccessfully tried to do exactly 4 years earlier. Sameer Gandhi, the Sidley Austin attorney, had flown into town overnight from New York, and the scene he witnessed at the Renaissance Hotel resembled a funeral home. The Caribbean delegates in particular were stunned. Some were openly weeping. While others furiously protested it was a big conspiracy. Nobody could believe that Jeffrey Webb, the great reformer, the Caribbean hope, had in fact been a crook. Amid all the gnashing of teeth, Gandhi presented an action plan. The Confederation needed to immediately launch an internal investigation, both to figure out how much Webb had stolen and to determine how large its criminal exposure might be. "Will you retain us?" he asked the delegates. For the second time in 3 years, CONCACAF was investigating itself for corruption. The following day, May 29th, Sepp Blatter stood for re-election, ignoring growing legions of angry protesters gathering outside Zurich's Hallenstadion, where the vote would be held. Taking the podium before the association's 209 members, he derisively cast aside arguments that 17 years atop FIFA was finally enough. "What is this notion of time? Time is infinite, and we slice it up. I find the time I've spent at FIFA is very short, and it will remain short," Blatter defiantly said. "I would quite simply just like to stay with you." The feeling appeared mutual. Just 2 days after the world learned there was a huge and ongoing criminal investigation that blatantly compared the organization over which he presided to the Mafia, Blatter was elected to a fifth term. He easily outdistanced Prince Ali, 133 votes to 73, in the first round of voting, leading his rival to withdraw. The following day, Blatter told a radio reporter that the arrests had been carefully planned to undermine his mandate. "With all the respect to the judicial system of the U.S., he said, "if they have a financial crime that regards American citizens, then they must arrest these people there and not in Zurich, when we have a Congress." On Sunday, Jack Warner, out of jail on bond, released two videotaped interviews he'd conducted, dressed in the lime-green colors of his political party. He, too, accused the United States of conspiring against soccer, claiming that no one gives them the right to do what they are doing. As proof of the plot, Warner held up a printout of a news article from an American publication. "FIFA frantically announces 2015 Summer World Cup in United States," the headline read. "If FIFA is so bad, why is it the U.S. wants to keep the World Cup?" Warner asked, an incredulous look on his face. "Take your losses like a man and go." But Warner's allegations soon turned him into a punchline, when it was revealed that the article he cited had come from The Onion, a satirical publication. Then on Monday came another leak. The New York Times, once again quoting unnamed sources close to the American criminal investigation, reported that Jerome Velk, Blatter's general secretary, had personally approved transfer of the $10 million bribe paid to Jack Warner by South Africa as part of its scheme to win the 2010 World Cup. The next day, June 2nd, FIFA summoned reporters to its Hilltop headquarters for an unscheduled press conference. Given short notice, only a few dozen journalists arrived in time to watch Blatter, in a blue suit and striped tie, take the podium. "FIFA needs a profound overhaul," Blatter said, speaking in French. "While I have a mandate from the membership of FIFA, I do not feel that I have a mandate from the entire world of football. The fans, the players, the clubs, the people who live, breathe, and love football as much as we all do at FIFA. Therefore, I have decided to lay down my mandate at an extraordinary elective Congress. I will continue to exercise my functions as FIFA president until that election." It was extraordinary. Something soccer fans could not have imagined only a week earlier. Sepp Blatter, just re-elected as overlord of world soccer 3 days earlier, was going to resign. "A great day for football," read the headline in the British tabloid The Daily Mirror. "Blatt's all, folks," crowed the Daily Express. By a somewhat stark coincidence, United Passions, a $27 million film ordered up by Blatter and almost entirely paid for by FIFA,